says it has over 120 kilos of 20% enriched uranium and will maintain its self-reliance on supplying the Tehran research reactor with fuel. People in Iraq head to the polls for early parliamentary elections amid tight security across the country. Israeli settlers backed by regime forces again stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. Good to have you with us. Top story this hour, Iran criticizing the International Atomic Energy Agency for failing to condemn an act of sabotage against its Karaj nuclear site on the 23rd of June. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the IAEA would have silenced, effectively encouraged this type of terror attack. Islam says that the agency was not allowed to replace damaged cameras as required under the Iran nuclear deal, because of the non-compliance with relevant obligations by the U.S. and Europeans. Islami noted that Iran won't tolerate the IAEA's double standard. It stressed that Iran is pushing ahead with its civilian nuclear program, adding that the country has more than 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium. It said that Iran will maintain its self-reliance on supplying the Tehran research reactor with fuel. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has paid an official visit to Syria. His effort talks with President Bashar al-Assad and top officials on regional developments and mutual ties. Our correspondent has more from Damascus.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in the Syrian capital, Damascus, and met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They discussed the military condition in Syrian soil. President Assad stressed that work will continue until liberating all Syrian territories from terrorism and ending foreign illegal presence. Talks also covered regional and international developments, including the situation in Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian briefed President Assad on the Iranian nuclear file negotiations, expressing Iran's goal to achieve sustainable development. He said Iran wants to cooperate with its neighbors to break the economic siege on his country and neutralize sanctions imposed on the Iranians. Amir Abdullahian also underlined the importance of boosting economic cooperation with Syria.
In the past weeks, we reached important agreements for a full development of relations between both countries in all fields, as well as setting programs for implementing such cooperation agreements in economic, trade, and tourism sectors.
Amir Abdullahian also discussed with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal al-Mahdad, recent developments, including the results of his talks with Lebanese and Russian officials related to the Syrian crisis. Mahdad expressed Syria's full support to Iran in its nuclear file.
Syria fully supports Iran in its efforts in the nuclear issue. We strongly condemn the U.S. moves aimed at manipulating Iran's nuclear program and other regional affairs.
This is the second visit for the top Iranian official to Syria in less than 2 months. His trip is part of an international and regional tour which started in Russia. Abdullahian's visit sends a clear message to the enemies of the resistance alliance that decades-long ties between the two countries are constantly developing despite Western and Israeli pressures on both states. It's clear that the two countries maintain the same stance that resistance is the only path to victory in the face of their mutual enemies. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Polls have opened in Iraq for an early election that's being held in response to the 2019 street protests. This is the fifth parliamentary vote since the ouster of former dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003. Nearly 25 million Iraqis are eligible to cast their ballots. 3,500 candidates, including some 1,000 women, are vying for 329 seats in parliament. Preliminary results are expected on Monday. Iraqi top Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani has called for a large voter turnout. Security is tight. All airports are closed until Monday morning. More than 250,000 security personnel have been deployed to secure polling stations across Iraq. Israeli settlers backed by regime forces have once again stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. the settlers desecrated the holy site to perform Jewish rituals. Such incursions into the compound regularly lead to clashes with Palestinian worshippers. Israeli troopers used force to clear the way for the settlers. The latest storming comes just days after an Israeli lower court allowed Jews in a ruling to offer prayers at the Al-Aqsa. And that has sparked condemnations from the Palestinians' resistance movement Hamas, warning that any Israeli attempt to defy the mosque will have damaging consequences for the regime. On Friday, another Israeli court, however, overturned the lower court's decision and upheld the ban on non-Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa. I talked to our correspondent Ramallah, Mona Kendall, gave us some more details regarding the Israeli settlers' incursion into the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, Israeli settlers are used to, unfortunately, to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They claim it's only for touring the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and not performing their rituals or their silent prayers. What happened this morning is that the Israeli settlers and groups stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex with the protection of Israeli police, of course, and they performed their rituals and their Jewish prayers, the silent prayers, and the Israeli police officers were protecting them. Palestinians continue to prevent the settlers from raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they continue to force them leave the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. However, when the Israeli forces are there, they protect the settlers, they attack the people, the Palestinian worshippers and the Muslim worshippers there. They fire tear gas in order to ensure the protection of the Israeli settlers.
Condemnations are pouring in over Friday's deadly bomb blast targeting a Shiite mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has condemned the attack, urging Afghan officials to punish the perpetrators. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Afghan authorities to take measures and prevent such terrorist acts. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, also denounced it, saying that Islamic nations and the international community have left the Afghan people alone. He called on the Afghans to boost their national unity and solidarity and take steps to protect civilians from Daesh terrorists. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has slammed the attack, saying that such terror acts are against all religions and humanitarian law. The Daesh-claimed attack during the Friday prayers killed dozens of worshippers, injuring scores more. Life in Kabul and at the face of the city have changed after 8 weeks since the Taliban assumed power in the Afghan capital. Our correspondent has more.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with many selling the new banner somewhat heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes, and houses. I make good money, and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women are seen to be staying off the streets, but some are seen in longer coats and headscarves, and some in the all-covering burqa. Fewer men are seen wearing Western dress as they have switched to local clothes. The Taliban takeover changed the face of capital Kabul in many ways. The nation's already flagging economy is collapsing and creeping cases in the making. It remains to be seen what future holds for the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The French Interior Minister has called for the start of talks for a migration treaty between the European Union and Britain. Gerald Darmanin said it's necessary to negotiate migration issues since Michel Barnier, the bloc's former chief negotiator, did not do so when he negotiated Brexit. Darmanin underlined that France will steer the project when it takes over the EU's rotating presidency in January. He also urged the British government to uphold its promise to finance the fight against illegal immigrants who gather on the northern French coast to cross into England. The issue of the trafficking of migrants across the English Channel has been a constant source of friction between Paris and London. France says it currently bears the cost of maintaining border security and illegal migration. Thousands of Italians have taken to the streets of Rome to protest the extension of the COVID-19 health pass. Hundreds of police officers in riot gear were deployed to areas in Rome. Scuffles broke out between demonstrators and police. Last month, the government announced that the scheme would be extended to all workplaces by mid-October. Under the scheme, any employee refusing to comply would be threatened with suspension without pay. The pass has already been a requirement to enter museums, sporting events, and other public places since August. Russia has reported a record number of daily COVID-19 deaths as the disease keeps taking its toll on that country. There were 968 new fatalities in the past day, pushing the deaths to more than 216,000. There were also well over 29,000 new infections, taking the caseload to 7.7 million. Russia is the worst-hit country by the coronavirus in Europe. Officials previously warned the nation is facing a looming fourth wave of the pandemic. High infection rates are driven by the Delta variant and relatively low vaccination drive. Only around 27% of the country's entire population has been fully vaccinated. Okay, moving on. Taiwan saying it will not bow to pressure to accept China's rule as tensions escalating between Taipei and Beijing over the self-ruled island's independence bid. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen says that there should be absolutely no illusion that the Taiwanese people will bow to such pressure. She said that nobody can force Taiwan to take the path China has laid out for it. The president, however, expressed hope for the easing of tensions with Beijing, which flared up after Chinese fighter jets flew over Taiwan's air defense zone earlier this month. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory, President Xi Jinping recently vowing to realize a peaceful reunification with the island. Beijing is also angry over Taipei's growing military reliance on Washington. The small airliner has crashed in Russia's Tatarstan region, killing 16 people on board. The L-410 aircraft went down near the town of Menzilinsk. The twin-engine short-range transport plane was carrying parachute jumpers when it went down. The cause of the crash is yet to be investigated. The Russian Emergencies Ministry says that 7 people have been pulled alive from the wreckage. The survivors sustained injuries, but their condition is not known. The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency says it has created a top-level working group on China. The spy agency describes the move as part of a broad U.S. campaign focused on countering Beijing's growing influence across the Asia-Pacific region and elsewhere in the world. Now, the question is if the rising tensions between the two top economies usher in a new Cold War.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing.
Sana'a has slammed the UN Human Rights Council for dropping its probe into war crimes the Saudi-led coalition has committed in Yemen. The Yemeni foreign minister described the move as disregard for international humanitarian law and a disgrace for the council. It said that Riyadh and its allies will not succeed in hiding their atrocities in Yemen. The ministry warned that not extending the probe gives the aggressors the green light to continue their crimes with impunity. On Thursday, the UN top rights body announced an end to its probe into war crimes in Yemen. The decision has already drawn strong criticism from a number of countries and human rights bodies. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Women's growth and progress thanks to the Islamic Republic. The 3rd of February, 2021. Islam considers men and women to be equal in terms of human values. For Muslim men and women, for believing men and women, for devout men and women, for true men and women, for men and women who are patient and constant. The Holy Quran 33:35. Muslim men and women are not different from one another in terms of divine and human values. They have common duties such as enjoining the good, rendering services and doing jihad in the way of God. Each of these duties is somehow shared by both men and women, and they are not particular to men or to women. And each has particular duties. Women have particular duties and men have particular duties. And Allah, the Exalted, has created their bodies and their souls in line with these duties. So, this is the viewpoint of Islam in the Islamic Republic towards women, and we are proud of it. We are completely against the Western logic, methodology, and lifestyle about women, and we believe that they are oppressing women. Western propaganda massively promotes the idea that the Islamic perspective hinders women's growth and development. This is a clear lie and a completely biased statement. In our country, at no point in history, neither in the past nor in the era of westernization, did we ever have so many educated women active in social, cultural, and scientific areas. We did not have all these women capable of influencing the social destiny. We did not have all these women with the power to understand and analyze political affairs. And we did not have so many female writers, female translators, and female artists in the true sense of the word. All these have been achieved thanks to the Islamic Republic and the viewpoint of Islam on women, which is based on respect. Now, I deem it necessary to express my respect for martyrs, mothers, and wives in two different generations. One during the sacred defense era, and the other during the defense of the holy shrines. In those eras, martyrs, wives, and mothers played a really determining and unique role, and one should bow down before them in respect. Unfortunately, there are few artistic productions about these dear and great personalities. This is an extraordinarily outstanding capacity for which there is more room for work.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States, has long been on a confrontational course with Russia. Developments on the ground on Russia's western borders and elsewhere are pointing to increasing tensions between the two sides. The Western Alliance has been moving military hardware and ground forces to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The situation in Ukraine has turned into another serious bone of contention. NATO and Russia have been flexing their military muscles. The two have shown through their military drills and deployments, as well as public statements, that they are serious about pursuing their geopolitical interests in the Baltic region, the Middle East, and even in the Arctic. Meanwhile, America's ongoing efforts to complete a comprehensive missile system in Europe have further worried Moscow. Radars, warships, and long-range missile interceptors placed across Europe form components of the controversial system.
Without the Soviet Union, NATO does not need to exist, and they are clinging for dear life. They're trying to justify, to create a reason for them to be there and to continue to exist, and that's why they're constantly provoking Russia when Russia is not the Soviet Union. They are not the threat that the Soviet Union was.
As NATO expands eastward, Russia is not sitting idly by. It has adopted a set of countermeasures. For instance, Russia has used its westernmost territory, Kaliningrad, as a platform to boost its defenses. The territory is located between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. Moscow has deployed the Iskander missiles and its S-400 air defense systems in Kaliningrad. NATO and Moscow have maintained contacts to try to minimize risks. The Russian Federation has had an observer mission to the Western Alliance. It was meant to promote cooperation in common security areas. This week, tensions between the two sides escalated once again after NATO expelled some members of the Russian mission. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the organization expelled the 8 Russian diplomats over a rise in, quote, malign activities by Moscow. The Russian government was quick to slam NATO's decision. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that there is an obvious inconsistency in statements by NATO representatives about their desire to normalize relations with Russia and in their actual actions. He added that such actions allow Moscow not to develop illusions about the normalization of relations. Meanwhile, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, Leonid Slutsky, warned of asymmetric retaliatory measures. How will this latest episode of tensions between the two sides play out? NATO's relations with Moscow have largely been tied to the policies of the United States. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Joe Biden has made it clear that his administration will be tough on Moscow. In his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed 2 new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden has repeated accusations of interference in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses against Russia. Washington and Moscow were also locked in a dispute over embassy staffing, which could further sour their ties. Analysts believe that the rivalry between the Russian Federation and the West, including NATO, is too deep-rooted to be solved in any foreseeable future.
The biggest ever data leak in history has exposed hidden offshore assets worth millions of dollars, allegedly tied to 35 current and former world leaders and more than 300 other public officials from over 90 countries. Nearly 3 terabytes of data, dubbed the Pandora Papers, were leaked to the Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Over 600 journalists helped review 12 million documents leaked from 14 financial services companies. Jordan's King Abdullah, a close U.S. ally, was reported to have used offshore accounts to spend more than $100 million on luxury homes in the United Kingdom and the United States. The papers also accused the family and close associates of Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev of corruption, suggesting that they've traded close to £400 million in UK property over the past 15 years through a network of offshore firms. The papers have also implicated the Czech Prime Minister, presidents of Ukraine, Cyprus, Kenya, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other high-profile figures.
Because people don't want to solve it. It's very simple. I mean, first of all, bear in mind the central banks around the globe have opened up their money spigots to extraordinary levels since the 2008 financial crisis. So as a result, you have tons and tons and tons of capital circulating around the world, unregulated, looking for the highest profit levels, etc. And the banking sectors are making lots and lots of money over this.
While having offshore firms and accounts isn't illegal, the papers allege that some of the companies have helped officials hide their wealth, practically enabling them to evade paying taxes, while some others have used them for money laundering and other fraudulent financial schemes. According to the Pandora Papers, over a dozen U.S. states are providing financial secrecy services that rival those of offshore tax havens in Europe and the Caribbean region. The documents single out South Dakota, which has allegedly sheltered billions of dollars in assets linked to people previously accused of financial crimes. The investigation says South Dakota state lawmakers have adopted lax regulations drafted by trust industry insiders, measures that have quadrupled customers' trust in the state compared to 10 years ago. Some of the trusts cited in the probe are linked to people accused of human rights and labor abuses. The revelations come despite President Joe Biden's pledge that Washington will lead the efforts internationally to promote financial transparency and fight against corruption.
Now, the U.S., for example, talks about equalizing tax rates, shutting down tax havens, et cetera, but in fact, individual U.S. states have been opening their doors wider and wider to these kinds of activities. South Dakota is one example, Nevada is another, and a third is Delaware, a small state on the East Coast, which is home to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's history, he essentially is a product of this anything-goes, hot-money corporate culture.
The rich and powerful people cited in the large-scale investigation have already begun to deny wrongdoings and in some cases express readiness to undergo scrutiny. What's for certain is that they have a lot to answer for in their respective countries for the months or even years to come.
Iran has long voiced concern over the covert presence of Israeli regime's proxies as well as Daesh terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists were brought into the region at the height of the 2020 conflicts between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. On Friday, Iran's army ground force launched a military drill codenamed Khaybar near the country's border with Azerbaijan and Armenia. The drill was attended by armored, artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division. Islamic Republic's armed forces regularly hold military exercises to increase their military prowess and preparedness. The drills also send a clear and powerful message to enemies against any acts that challenge Iran's security,
sovereignty, and territorial integrity. On Sunday, during a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. Ayatollah Khamenei said the interference of foreign actors in the region is a source of discord and damage, calling on the regional states to follow the example of Iran for power and rationality.
Israel considers Iran its mortal enemy and will do whatever it can to strengthen any of Iran's neighbors and try to draw them away from any kind of alliance with Iran. So that's partly what this is all about. Now, Iran, of course, has every right to have military exercises in any part of its country that it wants to. So the fact that it's having them in its northern border near Azerbaijan is not surprising.
Iran has long criticized Azerbaijan's military ties with Israel, which include purchases of Israeli arms such as drones and other weapons that helped Baku gain the upper hand in the war with Armenia last year. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute think tank, Israel provided Azerbaijan with some $825 million in weapons between 2006 and 2019. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has expressed Tehran's concern about Israel and terrorist elements threatening the security of neighboring Azerbaijan. The Iranian diplomat highlighted the importance of mutual relations between Tehran and Baku in the context of neighborly relations and expressed dismay over the recent negative statements by the Republic of Azerbaijan. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. However, Iran's foreign ministry reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drill was meant to secure regional peace and security. Iran's foreign minister said Tehran will not tolerate Israel's presence near the country's borders and will take due measures against the regime's activities.
United States and Israel support anti-Iran terrorist groups. The United States openly supports the MEK, which is an anti-Iranian terrorist group. So the goal, of course, is to start a war that the Israeli regime and the U.S. regime will be able to say is the responsibility of Iran. This is not the case at all.
But why should Tehran hold a grudge against Tel Aviv? It has been an open secret that Israel, along with the United States, have been responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's civilian nuclear program over the past decade. Also, Iran blames Israel and the U.S. for assassinating its top nuclear scientists in order to hamper its eye-catching advances. Israel also sees this as an opportunity to act against Iran militarily, although indirectly. Any moves that prompt secession from Iranian territory is something Israel welcomes. Yet, in Iran's eyes, that is just a pipe dream, as relayed through its military exercises. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has also said that holding military exercises by a state within its territory is part of its national sovereignty.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Very welcome to the show, Viewpoints. So regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran on the concept of human being, and the we can say the most important speeches that the rahbar gave on the role that the human being might have in today's world, there have been a series of discussions, and we try to get into the different dimensions and angles of the life of the human beings. Now, for today's discussion, we want to talk about a very important topic with which the today's generation and also today's movement are also very engaged with, and that is freedom. They somehow define it as liberty. But I think freedom is a better term when we are talking about the Islamic one, because liberty might have root in some specific humanism in the Western theology and philosophy, but freedom in Islam might be defined in a different way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are two things we need to look at in depth when we talk about liberty or freedom. To understand what it is that we're talking about when we talk about freedom or liberty. One is it absolute freedom? Everyone makes their own rules, no restrictions. Or is it just freedom from unjust, unfair, irrational restrictions? The first one, the absolute freedom, no one can really believe in. It doesn't hold up. Some people might profess this, but in practice, you cannot have this, right?
You mean absolute freedom?
Absolute freedom.
That's what?
You cannot have absolute freedom,
okay,
because you will be restricting other people's freedom.
That's right.
At some point. So the question becomes, how do we define unjust and unfair restrictions to get rid of them? And it needs a value system. In the West, it's based on different philosophies or materialistic worldview.
Liberal
in Islam,
capitalism, for example, nowadays talks about liberty.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. And in Islam, it's based on Tawheed.
Yes.
The second thing that we need to talk about is that, is it external freedom, which is more associated with the word liberty?
That's right.
Being liberated from something external, or is it internal freedom? Internal from our own desires, our own wants, our own negligence, our own ignorance. Which one is it? And because a materialistic worldview is more concerned with the external world, in the West we see so much emphasis on the first type.
That's right.
And in Islam, we definitely have more emphasis on the second type, on internal freedom. And if you have internal freedom, you might be a prisoner, but you're a free man.
That's right. So you might be, you might not be free in terms of whatever you want to do in terms of the materialistic world, in physical terms around yourself, which of course led into so many catastrophes during the history of the Western, philosophy. We'll get to that. But internally, it's a type of freedom that you have. In Arabic, they call it Hurriya, isn't it?
Yes.
You become a whore. You become like a free man. That whether, you know, you be a prison or a small place or not be engaged in any materialistic kind of world, but inside you sense a kind of freedom, which has roots in divinity. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadat. Just these two categorizations by you for now?
Yeah, I think these two are very important.
Okay.
Understanding the meaning of freedom.
That's all right.
We start talking about it.
So what about you, Brother Ali? How do you define freedom in terms of the Islamic terms?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. I believe freedom is one of the most oppressed terms in the course of history that actually has been violated, because it is being said that some believe that they are actually believing freedom, but in practice, in reality, they really violate the freedom of themselves and the others. So in order to see what freedom is in an Islamic context and comparing to a Western or let's say humanistic worldview, we need to actually differentiate. We need to focus on these two worldviews. In an humanistic worldview, freedom is defined around the humanism, because the person, the individual, is important and is looked at as the center of the universe and the center of the world.
Okay.
So whatever is going to be defined as freedom actually rounds about the personality of the person, the individual. Whatever is good to him actually is appreciated and is respected, and whatever is bad for the person actually is rejected. And it is seen as something unrestricted, but in actuality it is restricted, because actually it violates the rights of others, and they come to make an agreement, or what they call it, a law, to define it and to limit it to some certain rules, but and they also actually reach to a way that it says that let's look at the will of the majority of the people in society, what is called as democracy. Again, why I said that even this freedom is being violated, because democracy in the most democratic, let's say, governments or let's say countries, we see that democracy is not actually the will of the majority of the people. We see that in practice it is the will of, let's say, a limited group of people who are ruling over the others, because those who democratically are elected or selected as the representatives of the people, later on they become those limited number of groups of people who are actually make decisions for the others.
Especially when we take a look at the Western world.
Exactly.
We see that
the capitalistic.
This liberal capitalism has its own problems,
mm-hmm.
which cannot be the same prescription for all the people from all cultures,
very
all
true.
Around the world with different races and languages. Although I think the elites part of the society, which have their own role in shaping this democracy, have their own problems too. We see it, for example,
democracy theoretically in what is being said or written is not actually that bad to say that. Okay, it can be actually modified to a better, let's say, form. But the most important element, which is actually missing in democracy, is the role of God.
That's right.
What we can actually vividly see it in the Islamic worldview towards freedom. We say human being is free in the line with Allah's worship and submission to Allah.
That's right.
Well, in a tawhidi or in a tawhidi context.
In a monotheistic context.
So in that we say that human is free, is not actually submissive to anyone in the world, any entity, any actual existence, except God. So which one is more free? The freedom that actually is circling around a person, but it is being defined by different elements, like different other peoples, other elements, like people, like groups, like political groups and parties, or the freedom that is being defined around the concept of God. So you mean that you are totally free, but your freedom is on the way, in line with Allah's worship and Allah's submission. So we believe that the freedom that is talked about in Islam is much more wider than the freedom that actually is looked at in the humanistic worldview. And by mystic, they actually claim, or they accuse Muslims or the followers of the Islam, that they have no freedom. But in reality, we see the results.
Not only the Muslims, but all the believers in the world from the other religions, are condemned for not having freedom or not living freely. But this is the life that we made for the people. For example, this is the land.
I'm asking, which is more actually restricted? The one whose freedom is being actually restricted by many elements, like this person, that person, this, let's say, capitalistic power, or the other, let's say, materialistic element.
That's right.
Or the one who is just limited to the words of God, or the submission to God. So it means that you are limited only from one side, and this side is good for your own spirituality, for your own existence, for your own tranquility.
And we see
so
that
which one is more beautiful and actually deserves to be thought about?
Especially nowadays, with the role that the media has, we could see what are the consequences of absolute freedom in terms of the materialism in the Western world. You see how much the rate of mass killing of the people. These are absolutely rooted in the freedom seeking of the people inside themselves. You know how much the rate of rape is increasing. You know the killing of the people, the wars here and there. These are all rooted because of the man-centrism that the people are looking for. But according to what you said, Brother Ali, the true freedom is rooted in the monotheistic Islam. But Sheikh Sadeq, what is this monotheistic look? I mean, if we want to explain it for our dear listeners, how the concept of Tawheed and freedom might be connected, how do you define it? How do you explain it?
It's a very good question. I think one of the verses in the Quran that talks about this is overlooked because it's mentioned within a story, the story of Prophet Yusuf.
Mm-hmm.
When the prisoners ask Prophet Yusuf about the meaning of their dreams, Prophet Yusuf first gives them a theology lesson. He asks them this very fundamental question. He asks, أَأَرْبَابُ مُتَفَرِّقُونَ خَيْرٌ أَمِ اللَّهُ الْوَاحِدُ الْقَهَّارُ. Which one is better, having just one God or many gods? And you can see that there is no option for no God.
Okay.
We're always a servant.
Yes.
So the only options are you either have one God or you have many gods.
That's right.
Because we're not gods, right? We're not invincible.
Yes.
We're always in need for different things. We need food. We need security. We need a lot of things to be able to sustain ourselves. So we either have one God who is our sustainer, who is our Razzaq, or we have many.